love you back. Stay tuned every Wednesday at 11:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 8:30 Pacific, with your hosts, Boyd and Lucinda, for the hottest talk show in existence. The streets don't love you back. I gotta do right before they
call me home. Good evening and welcome to the Streets Don't Love You Back show. Today is May 18th, 2011. I'm your host, Lucinda, with my co-host, Boyd, and our topic is, as always, the Streets Don't Love You Back. Join us every Wednesday night with real people, real stories, and real changes as we hear the truth about gangs, drugs, violence, abuse, and other life issues. We have a great show for you tonight. We have Mr. Kershawn Scott, also used to be known as Lil Monster. He grew up in South Central LA and was gang affiliated, and we're going to hear his story tonight. Before I welcome him, I'm going to welcome Boyd to the show.
Yeah, I just want to say, we thank my man for coming on the show tonight and definitely going to spread his message to the youth and others as well. And it's always a blessing to have someone come on the show who can lay the foundation down to where they came from and to what God done blessed them to be. So we're excited to have you tonight, and you can pass the mic over to my man and let him formally introduce himself, and we'll start the show up from here.
All right, Kershawn, go ahead and introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about you, how you grew up, you know, what your life was like as a youngster, and we'll go from there.
My name is Kershawn Scott. I did go by the name of Lil Monster as a member of the Crips, the A-Trey Gangster Crips. I moved to South Central with my family in 1972. And at the time, I was 7 years old. We moved from a predominantly white neighborhood to South Central. And although it wasn't as bad then in comparison.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
I'm having a technical difficulty here for a second. Hang on. Is it up?
Yeah.
Let's have it work. Okay.
Okay. Are we good?
I'm good now.
All right. Yeah, while South Central wasn't as bad in 1972 as it has gotten over the years, it was still bad to us. And,
right. Go ahead.
It took some getting used to. I mean, it was all foreign. You know, the gangs, the Crips were just getting started, you know, getting a foothold in the community. And for us, it was really hard. It took a few years to get acclimated to that style of living, you know, the constant police presence, the helicopters, the gunshots. All that was foreign to us. And we adapted. And eventually made a conscious decision, me and my brother did, to either remain victims or not. And we choose to no longer be victims. I do need to point out that it is six of us in my family. And I have two brothers who never got involved with gangs, and two sisters who never got involved with gangs. So I kind of followed my brother into it. It wasn't a conscious decision, like one day I just woke up and said, hey, today is the day I'm going to join. It was a gradual thing. Everybody that I grew up with, that I flew kites with, rode skateboards with, we gangbanged. And that
right.
was like the next logical step in the progression of life for us, unfortunately.
Right. And how many kids were in your family?
Six kids.
And where did you fall in that line?
I'm sorry. Could you repeat that?
All in the kids.
I'm the youngest.
Okay.
It's four boys and two girls, and me and my brother Sanika, also known as Monster Cody, we were the youngest. We are the youngest, and with him being about 18 months older than me.
Okay. And so it was just a way of life for you guys. You guys just kind of followed in their footsteps, and that was just the thing to do.
Yeah.
In your neighborhood.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, I followed in his footsteps, and he was just, you know, he was just going with his own mind, and that's what he wanted to do. Again, you know, I have two older brothers who never got involved with it.
Okay. And so the older two weren't in gangs, and then Cody was just a little bit older than you.
Yeah.
And so Cody was involved in a lot of stuff. He was also known as Monster out on the streets. And what happened to get you in trouble at I think you were 15?
Yes. Well, I had been in and out of probation camps already, just, you know, stolen cars and robberies and stuff like that. And then New Year's Eve of 1980, my brother was ambushed and shot five times. And the next night, which was January 1st, 1981, I retaliated. And a few weeks later, I was arrested and convicted for one count of first-degree murder and four counts of attempted murder. By the grace of God, I was 15 and tried as a juvenile. And that gave me a second chance at life, really.
Right. If you were convicted, obviously, as an adult, you probably would have spent at least 20 years to life or something.
Yeah, I would have gotten 25 years to life. There were five other people with me. And they were all tried as adults. Two were 16, two were 17, and one was 18. They were all tried as adults and convicted of second-degree murder. They all received 15 years to life, and none of them have been released as of yet.
Wow. That's sad. And you did five years.
Yeah, I did 5.5 years. I've been out now 25 years.
Right. Good for you. Congratulations.
Well, yeah, again, I was fortunate to be so young.
Right.
You know, but I definitely have regrets. I have regrets about everything that took place that night. I have regrets about taking a life. You know, one of the things that I would say to the youth today is I would ask them a question. And I would ask them, are you familiar with Dr. King, with Malcolm X? And if so, would you kill them? And, of course, you know, the overwhelming response is going to be no, because you know what these people have brought to the table.
Right.
Well, I didn't know what that kid that I pushed off the planet, I didn't know what he was capable of. I didn't know what he could bring to the table. And yet I cut his life short without him ever reaching his potential. And that's heavy, because I took him away from my people.
And another thing, you know, I just want to, you know, give you big ups for changing your life around and doing the right thing as well, you know. And we got a guest on the line tonight. I just want to, you know, just for him to say something right quick. Is a very good friend of mine from my childhood, Mr. Orville Simpson. And he just got out of prison from doing 18 years. So I would just like him to say something right quick on the air. And number three.
All right.
You there, Bill? Orville. You there? You there, Bill? You there, Orville? Yeah. All right. I don't think he hears. Can you hear us, Kashawn?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Orville, can you hear us? Okay, he's not on there. Go ahead and finish what you were saying to the people.
Yeah, you know, we get caught up in the madness, and particularly at that age, during that time, we mistakenly thought that respect came from how tough we were, how good we were with our hands, or that it actually came out the end of a barrel. And,
right.
And all that is wrong. All that is abnormal behavior. It's abnormal thought process. And it keeps us down, and it just keeps all the madness. It just perpetuates all the madness. You know, I mean, we need to change. It's so much that we need to change, and we need to check, and we need to start with the mindset. You know?
Right.
I'm currently in the state of Maryland, and
okay,
I was out in Los Angeles a couple of weeks ago, and enjoying a sunny Sunday afternoon at the park, and some young cats came up to the park and started shooting. And
wow.
I didn't duck, I didn't run. And yet I wasn't even focused on the shooter. I was focused on all the children and the mothers who were trying to rush their children to safety. And I thought how sad this is. And I left that park. Fortunately, no one was hit or injured, fortunately. And I left that park thinking how we have to create safe zones. We have to protect our children because our children are our future. And if they can't go to the park without being in fear of being shot or of losing their life, if they can't go to school with one thing on their mind, which is to learn, then we have to change this. And what I want to bring to the table about that is we have to create what I call safe zones. Schools and parks have to be safe zones.
Definitely.
And I believe that everybody should and needs to get behind this. You know, it doesn't matter if it's New York, if it's Baltimore, if it's Atlanta, if it's Norman, Oklahoma, or South Central Los Angeles. We have to create these safe zones because we have to protect our children.
And that is correct, you know. And I think that I'm back on the line with the young man I was waiting on, Kashawn. I'm going to punch him in
okay.
Right quick.
Okay.
Yeah, Orville, is you there?
Yeah, I'm here, man. You hear me?
Yeah, my man. Hey, I just want to let all our viewers know that this is a very joyful moment for me right now. One of my childhood homeboys, Mr. Orville Simpson, just stepped home after doing 18 years in prison. He's been out a week, and we just want to give him a big ups here on the show tonight. And he's definitely a force to be recognized out here at helping the youths and helping catch learn about the Streets Don't Love You Back as well. So we just wanted to give him a big ups and a big shout out tonight, you know? So
Thank you, brother.
Yeah, with them words being said, you can give a little announcement on your own right now, Bill, and formally introduce yourself.
Well, my name is Simpson. I've been home now for a little over a week now, approximately about 11 days. I've been working. I finally got a job. I'm driving trucks for Salvation Army now.
Good.
I've been speaking at a few engagements. I went to Central High School here in Detroit, spoke to a few of the kids, and had a big reception behind it. And hopefully I can keep doing that. I'm looking forward to working with you guys and making some things happen over here in Detroit, you know.
That's right. You know, and... Orville, can you explain to the listeners that until just recently you thought you were in prison for life?
Oh yeah.
And that you were actually put in prison on a your very first offense. You'd never been in trouble or anything. Could you just explain that a little bit?
Well, yeah, I can speak on it a little. I was doing wrong. I got caught selling drugs, you know, large amounts of drugs. And though it was a first-time offense, it was still wrong to be doing that. And like the young man was saying, well, that's part of tearing down the community. You know, though I've been gone 20 years, now I see the effects of what I've done,
mm-hmm.
you know. And then when you look at all that, you say, wow, I had a lot to do with this. And the neighborhood is just, it looks like a bomb been dropped since I've been home.
It looks like a third world country there on the east side of Detroit.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, everything is just trees is coming up through houses.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing that I can't believe this. You know, I'm just wondering what's next. You know,
right? And could you tell the listeners right quick, Orville, when you got that life sentence, how you fell up under the 650 law in Detroit at that time?
Yeah, well, the 650 law consisted of life. It consisted of it didn't care if you was a first time offender or not. If you get caught with 650 grams or more, it was life. They didn't care nothing about your past record or if you was first-time offender, they don't care nothing about that. Luckily, I kept a good record in prison and had a public hearing, and I was released. Even though I still got 4 years to do on parole, I'd rather do that than sitting behind the bars, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, we're glad to have you home, and you know, we know that you went through a lot, and you also learned a lot, and you have a lot to teach others and share with others, so... We look forward
That's my main goal, is to, now that I'm home, to try to reach out to the youth,
right.
You know, and try to let them know that the fox is not worth the chase.
Exactly.
You know, you can sit and watch it. You know, the guys riding around in their fancy cars, but they don't live long.
Right.
You know, they wear the nice jewelry, the nice clothes, but they don't live long. Next time you look, they doing 100 years in prison too. You
right.
know, waiting on fan mail.
Now, I don't know if you heard the very beginning of the show or not, Orville, but we have Kershawn Scott on the line, and he grew up in South Central L.A., and he did some prison time for revenge. You know, they murdered somebody that shot up his brother. So he's telling his story here tonight, and I don't know if Kershawn has a question for you or anything, but I just wanted to let you know he was also here with us.
Kershawn. Yeah, how you doing,
nice
brother?
Nice to meet you, brother. Nice to meet you.
I know that you are enjoying your freedom.
Oh, yes, sir.
Congratulations on obtaining that freedom, because you're right, bro. It's better to do 4 years out here on parole than one day in the cage.
That's right.
You know, so right. I want to congratulate you on obtaining your freedom and being on the right path. When you said that it looked like a bomb had been dropped on the east side of Detroit, as you were formulating that, I was thinking the same thing, that it looked like a bomb had been dropped there. And that's what we have been doing in our communities, be it from the smallest corner drug seller to the cat moving all the way. We are destroying our communities, from the cat who's gangbanging writing on the walls.
It's okay to talk about it, but now that we're home, it's time that we, the same communities that we helped destroy, it's time for us to come home and help try to build them back up now, though. That's what we have to do. We can't just keep talking. We have to start being active, you know?
That's a fact. Now,
we have to become more active in the community, building it back up, you know, like Habitats for America, you know, for humanity, how they go around and build houses back up in the community. We have to also start doing that.
That's a fact. You know, when I came home in 1986, of course, my people came by and they saw me, and at the end of the day, I had several thousand dollars in cash and 9-10 ounces of dope, which I had never seen before in my life. And I didn't know what to do with the dope. I put it in a bag and I put it in a drawer. Well, about a month later, now I'm broke, still with no job. And I got out there with the dope. And it's funny because the first night that I decided that I was going to sell dope, I was also supposed to start a job, and this was going to be my first job ever. And the job paid minimum wage, which at that time was $5.25, and I was supposed to start that night at 10:30, and I got out there on the block at about 6 o'clock, and by 10 o'clock, I had made $4,000, and I knew then I wasn't going to that job. So that's what I did for the next 3 years, was basically sell drugs, and I just fell right back into the same old, the track, you know, the fast money, the street life. And my first son was born in 1989, and at that time, right there in the hospital, as I held him, I said, he will never see me in jail. He will never have to come see me in jail. And it was at that time that I began to change my life. And I started first with myself for my son. And then, I started with myself for myself. But then I wanted to change my community for my son so he could be safe.
That's right.
And one of the first things that I did, we used to always hang out on this one block. And the neighbors always called the police on us. You know, it didn't matter if we were out there just chilling are out there raising hell. They always called the police on us. So just fed up with it. I went and got me a notepad, a legal notepad, and a pen, and I went and knocked on every door on that block. And I asked them, what's the problem that you have with us out here? And the response was overwhelming. And I finished each conversation up with these people on their doorstep by giving them my number, and I told them, if you have a problem over here, before you call the police, call me and let me see if I can come defuse the problem. And the responses that I got from the people were, we were loud and disrespectful. We kept the block dirty and made it unsafe for them. They felt unsafe and basically in fear. So one of the first things I did is I went to the local surplus and I got a few trash cans, some brooms, and some rakes, and I positioned the trash cans strategically on the block. And I told my homeboys, when you come back from Taco Bell or McDonald's, put your wrapper, your trash, in the trash can. Don't throw your beer bottle on the ground. Put it in the trash can. When you see old lady Mrs. Jones struggling to get her trash can out, go help her. As a matter of fact, you know when the trash day is. Go get her trash can. And within 3 weeks, everything had changed on that block. And the same people who were calling the police on us were now saying, hey, baby, you hungry? Or you can come in my house. The police are not coming here. It's safe.
That's what we call making a difference. You're giving back to the community.
And you know what? Now, I have to tell this story. On the end of this block was an A&E church. And one of my homies had been going to this church since he was a kid. So he knew the pastor, you know, really well. So I asked him to set up a meeting with the pastor. This was 1989, towards the end of 1989, early 1990. And he set the meeting up. I went in there, and I spoke with the pastor, and I told him what I had done on this block. A block that we see him drive up and down every day. And he told me that he was proud of the things that I was doing, but how could he help me? And I said, well, what I would like is 15 minutes of your congregation's time on Sunday. And this man looked me in my eye and told me, you know what? Again, I applaud what you're doing, but you don't have a damn thing to say that my congregation would want to hear. He told me just like, and I got up and I shook his hand and I thanked him for his time. Now, after the riots in 92, now, you know, I'm on Nightline and I'm on Larry King in 60 Minutes, and I'm hearing the buzz. The pastor, he wants to talk to you. And I put him on hold for a couple of weeks before I actually went and spoke with him. And we sat there, and, you know, he told me, you know, you're getting a lot of media attention, and I don't think that you're equipped to deal with the media like I am. And I asked him, I said, do you know who I am? And he said, yeah, it seems like every time I turn my television on, there you are. And I said, no. And I went back over to the meeting we had a few years back. And he told me, oh, well, you know, that was then and I didn't know. And I said, well, if you would have given me the opportunity that I asked for, you would have known. Because I'm the same person. You know, so I look at that as a learning experience. I don't put anybody down because I believe that I can learn something from everyone. I don't think that I'm smarter than anybody else. I don't think that anybody is smarter than anybody. We know different things. And so from the youngest cat in the streets to the oldest cat in the streets, my ears are open, my eyes are open, and you're right, man. We have to put things in action. You know, we can't just talk about it.
Right. So, you know, we definitely feeling all of that, you know what I mean? And you got something to respond to that on, Ville?
No, I think he said enough, man.
My man, you know? My man.
No, I think he said enough.
So anybody you would like to give a shout out to, Ville, while you're on the show?
No, I just like to say thanks for allowing me to even participate on your show, man, and I hope to be able to do this again soon.
Oh, ain't no doubt, man. You know, we'll definitely have Mr. Ville on the show very soon, and you know, I just wanted to, you know, give him the recognition, you know. That's been my childhood friend for many years, and we're definitely going to be doing a lot of things with him and with the Streets Don't Love You Back movement, you know, because like he said, yeah, we definitely were some of the ones who tore up the city of Detroit back in the day, you know, and
right.
We have to.
I'm looking now that I'm home, Rob. I'm looking forward to Streets Don't Love You Back Part 2.
Oh, ain't no man. You silly, Bill. Ain't no question, man. You know what I mean? When me and the wife come up there, man, you know, that's going to be real soon. You know, I'm going to shoot on in and surprise you when we come through.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, it's a lot on the floor, man. And like I told you, I couldn't wait till you come home. And we've been putting together the intervention program and everything and the mentoring program. So you definitely already a part of that. And we're getting that started right here in Arizona as we speak, you know?
Yeah.
Right. And one of our goals has also been to open up the Boyd Learning Center in Detroit somewhere. So we do want to have a learning center where people can come and get their education and read and learn.
Oh, yeah. I like to be a part of that.
So we're happy to have our part of our Detroit team home so they can help us out over there.
That's right. Hey, y'all. Hey,
so,
I got to get up and go to work, man. So.
Okay, then, Ville, we appreciate you coming on the line, man. And, you know, call me when you get off the gig tomorrow, man. Have a good tomorrow, man. Stay blessed.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
All right, brother.
Okay, Callie.
All right now.
That's right, brother. Peace.
Peace.
Yeah, my brother. So we back with you, man. So, you know, we loving what you're doing out there in L.A., and, you know, I really dug on what you said on how you tried to approach the minister, and he acted like you wasn't even there. You know what I mean?
Right.
You know, so when you don't, you know a guy, you know, all real players don't come in no suit and tie, you know? And that's where he had got the game misconstrued, first of all, you know?
Right.
Second of all, you know, he thought he was the leader of the flock because he was in the church, you know? Well, it's a whole lot of people in the church that's leading you straight to hell, even though they're in front of the pulpit. So once he see and find out who you really is, you know, you're a homie from the block that's controlling things, now he want to talk, you know? But when he thought you was just a guy who's picking up beer bottles and buying trash cans, he thought you was just a peon until he did his homework.
Right.
And that's the problem with our black ministers out here today, You know, it's like three blocks over, you got kids starving, no food, you know, mama with lights out, but she's trying to make it three blocks over to the church to throw them tithes into the church, you know? But the minute she tell the pastor that, we need some groceries in the house or the light's about to get cut off, he gets amnesia, and the first thing he tell the congregation that God will provide. Okay, yeah, that's true, God will provide, but I done put my tithes in your church for 7 years, and I can't get no love, you know what I mean? So God did provide, because I put my tithes in your church, so he's been providing, but now it's time for you to provide something, and that's what's wrong with our ghetto preachers, I call them, you know what I mean? And they have to understand that this is not about the Cadillac or the Broham that you park up on the hill and, you know, you want everybody paying your bills and putting in the tithes in the church. And nowadays, they done got to the point where, you know, it's pastor's day, it's wife and pastor's day, and, you know, it's the let me buy a pair of alligator day. I mean, everybody got all these different days in church now, you know? But...
But, gotta have a nice suit and shoes.
But hey, little monster, if we look at the statistics of life from when we was all coming up, you know, the pastor always made sure the congregation was straight, you know? And as time went on, you know, then we had the ghetto pastors, as I call them, because now they trying to hustle the people. They ain't trying to preach the word. They hustling the people now. You feel me?
Yeah.
And long as they hustle off God, you know, and try to make people think they giving them the word, you know, you ain't gave us no fruit, you dig? You talk for 20 minutes and you done passed out 7 baskets for 7 different things at the spot, you know? I mean, yeah. I come to church with $20 and I thought I was going to throw in 5. You done took my whole 15, you know what I mean? After the
right.
So I'm leaving up out of here butt naked. You know what I mean? So... So they got to understand, man, that you have to follow your own mind and you have to follow who's doing what's real out here. Because the preacher in the pulpit ain't always him.
Right. Well, you know, the church used to be a focal point of the black community. It was the focal point of the black community. And as the 60s came to a close, so did that aspect of it.
Yes.
If you look now, you see most churches are not attended by the people in which the church sits.
At all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, so they're completely out of touch with the community in which they sit in.
Exactly. You know, they rather build a $17 million church than give somebody up the street a food and shelter.
Right. And, I mean, you know, you're right. I mean, you got these guys that you know, I mean, they don't give a damn about the community. They don't care one way or the other. It's about, like you said, lining their pockets. It's about the Cadillac and you know, the end of the story with me and this one pastor was this. Clearly, he wanted the media attention. Because he figured if he got the media attention, then he can draw funds that were coming in from the federal government to his church.
Amen.
Said, I'm working with this gang over here, and this is what we're doing, you know. So I told him, I says, well, you know what? I'm willing to bring the next media outlet that contacts me to you, but I'm going to want something in return. So, you know, sure, bro, what can I do for you? And I told him, I says, well, you know, when we hold gang meetings at the park, the police come. And I got people who are on parole who shouldn't be associating with other people. And it's a problem. So now he's like scratching his head like, well, how can I help that? And I told him I want to hold gang meetings in your church. And, bro, you can see the wheels turning. I mean, it was literally like a scale. Gang members in my church, money from the federal government. Gang members in my church, money. Of course, he opted for the gang members in his church. And so we held a couple of meetings in the church. And I told him, you know, I don't want you present. You know, I got this. And me being a man of my word, the next media outlet that contacted me, I brought him straight to Pastor Boyd. And it was a Shahi TV out of Japan. So it was never seen in this country.
Right. So you shot that move on him just on the strength.
Right.
We're going to put you in Japan, but we definitely ain't going to put you on the USA soil.
Right.
Japan ain't fine over here for the church.
Right. And shortly thereafter, he was transferred out because his church did not receive any of the federal funds that came into Los Angeles after the riots.
Amen. Because he didn't need them, because he was going to be using that for Pastor's Day and Wife's Day and all of that.
Get his, upgrade his Jags, you know.
Right. You know, yeah. He wouldn't have been talking about feeding the homeless, you know. And that's what a lot of cats fail to realize, too, man, that, you know, even though guys like me and you was doing wrong in that lifestyle, we had a sense of giving back to the neighborhood. You know, when Thanksgiving come or holiday come, everybody finna get turkey. Everybody's finna get a few dollars in their pocket, you know, because everybody's been cool. Everybody's been watching the police force. Everybody's been calling. Here they come. So you got to get rewarded for that, you know. And we did things like that, where though the church three blocks over, they don't care about giving you nothing if you ain't part of their congregation, because they barely get a congregation stuff.
Right. And of course, that's not to say that all churches are like that. But of course,
no,
there's...
But the majority of them is.
Right. There's so many churches. You know, they pop up. I mean, there was a liquor store last week, and this week is a church. You know, what I tell people is this. There's nothing wrong with being a religious person.
At all.
There's nothing wrong with being a spiritual person. You don't necessarily have to go to church to achieve that.
At all.
You know, I mean, and particularly, like I said, you know, what makes it a church? Because they put a cross up. You know, it was a liquor store last week. You know,
and the people make the church, you know, actually. It's the people that make the church.
That's a fact. That's a fact.
And we got a guest on tonight for you too, Kashawn. Miss Yolanda, we're going to punch her in, and she might have a few questions for you as well.
Okay.
You're on the air, Yolanda.
Hey, Miss Yolanda.
Hey, how y'all doing?
I'm good, baby.
Welcome.
Did you get your package today?
You know, I think it did come, but I tutor in the evening, and when I got back, the office was closed, but I'll get it, check it out in the morning.
Yes, I
always try to catch the mailman, but I'll get him tomorrow.
All right, that sounds good. Well, we got our man, Mr. Kashawn, on the line, and you can ask him a few questions.
Oh, well, how you doing, Kashawn?
I'm okay, Yolanda. How about yourself?
I'm great, thank you. I was just really enjoying your story and listening to what you had to say, and it's just wonderful to see. I'm a person, I do belong to a church, but I belong to a Unity Church. It's a non-denominational church, and it's not and you know, all that you were saying about the church and doing things, you know, that was one of the reasons Jesus left the institutions that he was. It wasn't a church at the time. He wasn't, you know, a Christian, of course. Is because, you know, it troubled him in his spirit that, you know, all the things that he had been taught and said that the people who were in charge weren't doing. They were about serving themselves, you know.
Right.
And he sought the higher truth. But, you know, now, and a lot of people, even in the Christian faith, you know, or whatnot, whatever, not even necessarily the Christian faith, seem to think that, you know, at the time, a lot of them that what these preachers and all these Christians, and, you know, they wear the tag and say, well, you ought to do this because you are a Christian. And then they start talking about Jesus. I say, well, first of all, Jesus wasn't a Christian. And I bet you if you lived when he lived, you wouldn't have been on his side. Because if he had more people on his side following him, you know, it's usually after people leave that they get noticed. He may not have been laying on the cross or been sought out to be crucified. He was an outlaw. You know, so you don't know when, or you don't judge people, or you don't say that you can't be enlightened, because when you get to know God, God is not in a box or in a book. You know, sure. you open your heart to receive it. And if you've noticed, like I noticed that there's a consciousness shift that's been taking place for the last 10 years. And you know, people who don't change, they're not going to be able to live on this planet. That old stuff doesn't work anymore. People are waking up. I mean, it's in our genetic code. We have to wake up. We've been living, you know, like, well, I guess you say in some ways, like animals, but we're spiritual beings having a human experience, and one that we chose. But just like you chose, you know, a lifestyle, you saw how when you change your mind and you followed it with action, you changed your world. And it's not hard because nobody bothered you. No one came up to you bullying you or telling you, you know, oh, well, or giving you a hard time about it. Just like when Rob, you know, made a conscious decision to do something different with his life, and LaFell, who was on here, you know, he said, nobody's going to come after you if you're doing something positive. They're not even going to bother you, you know. And so that's how you change it, with right action. And you know, depending on other people, which a lot of people have gotten, the church is the new codependent place. Well, you know, I hear so many people that are beat down in their life, especially now, and, yeah, they're going to the church, and the church, well, we don't have anything for you. You know, we can't help you. But if we can help each other in any way we can, you know, sharing wisdom like you're doing and reaching out to people, that's how you change your world, you know. And I just really appreciate you coming on and saying that and doing whatever you can to change it, because you see, it does look like a war zone. A war zone that is of our own making. I won't say you, ours, because you know, people in the community who sit back and felt helpless, you know, they attributed to.
Right.
And so I don't know what life is like now on the block site. I know there was someone here last week in California, and so are you finding that people are more readily now, even people that may still be associated with the gangs, are they, you know, willing to change? Are they, you know, seeing your light and wanting to follow it? Or what have you perceived as the attitude toward what you've been doing since, what, 80, you said 92 or 89,
90? 89.
Right.
Well, I think overwhelmingly people are ready to change. They want change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people are tired of dying, and let me point a few things out. That's evidence, because you know, it used to be one of the things with the gangs, the Crips and the Bloods, was it used to be about colors, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, now it's not. Crips wear red, Bloods wear blue. Crips and Bloods are hanging out together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, LAPD and the LA County Sheriff's Department, they want to take credit for the decline in gang-related murders, but it has nothing to do with them.
Mm-hmm.
It has everything to do with the people on the street, the participants, who are tired.
Mm-hmm.
Tired of looking over their shoulders, tired of going to funerals, tired of watching their people get maimed, and just tired. So, yeah,
mm-hmm.
People are ready for a change. But see, now here's the thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So many of us fall victim to peer pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sometimes it only takes one person. It only takes one person to say, you know, you soft.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and nobody wants to be viewed that way or considered soft. It's a respect thing. And again, going back to that word, respect, people have that twisted up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I would say, be your own person. If you feel that you're ready for a change, then take that step, because it starts with you. You
mm-hmm.
know what I'm saying? It starts with the individual person.
Mm-hmm.
And again, when I set out to change my life, it wasn't for the overall good of my community or to try to save the next brother's life. It was about trying to save my life so I can be there for my son.
Mm-hmm.
From there, it expanded to the point where yeah. now I can say I am in the business of saving lives.
Awesome.
You know, so, and it hasn't been easy. You know, I mean, I've never gone to anyone and asked for funding. You know, I've never gotten paid for doing the things that I do on the streets of L.A. And it's not about that for me. You know, again, it's about saving lives. It's about my kids being able to play outside in the front yard, and I don't have to worry about them being shot at or getting hit with a street bullet, you know? So, yeah. You know, it's about creating the next Martin Luther King, the next Malcolm X, and not taking that potential out of our community.
Krishan, you made a comment on part of your bio that I got that said that you and your brother and your crew, I guess, had a creed that if you hit me, I'll kill you. It wasn't get even. It was always get one up.
Wow.
And, you know, as harsh as that sounds and was, it seems like today's gangs are even worse than that. I mean, they're just out shooting to not even get even, just to do it. What do you feel about that? And how do you think that maybe we can reach out to these kids? Because we know, obviously, that the gangs are probably never going to go away. But how can we help change those gangs into something more positive and save lives instead of just, you know, all the violence that's out there?
Well, yeah, I believe that the youngsters today are definitely more violent. There's less thought process. What I say to that is this. One, what's it really about? You see, so many older cats, such as myself, are cats my age. I'm not going to say such as myself, but they romanticize the life. Oh, well, this is how we did it back then, you know. And these young cats, they listen to that. And then they aspire to be that. But they aspire to be that through the barrel of their gun, you know. Same with people getting out of prison, you know, and they're romanticizing their life in prison. Really? Was it that good? Because if it was, then go back. But don't come and tell an impressionable youngster how good you had it in prison. That doesn't make sense to me.
Right.
And these youngsters that get caught up in that. So again, we have to re-educate them to the importance of human life and, again, the potential within that human life. You know, that human life, that one person can change the world if you allow them to reach their full potential. It's a hard process, but it starts with one person, and it builds from there. You know, I'm one person, and, again, I started with myself, and I've been all over this country, and I've been out of this country, and people tell me, you know, I heard you speak or I saw you over here and it changed my life. It changed my views, you know. And that one person can then reach another person. And it just goes from there. You know, when I was a kid, when I was a young kid, you were out on the street corner or just out on the block doing that, old lady Mrs. Jones came out and she kicked your ass. And she sent you to the house. And you knew that by the time you got to the house, she had already called, so you knew you had another ass kicking coming when you got to the house. but see, we've lost that sense of community because now Ms. Jones, she's hiding behind her barred door. She's ducking behind her curtains. She's not going to come out there and tell you that you're doing wrong or come here, let me put this strap on you. She's going to call the police because she's in fear for the life of you.
Right.
And, I mean, we need to change all that, you know. There's, you know, one of the things that I was thinking about today is there's no sense of community, not just in communities like South Central, but throughout this country.
Right.
The only time people come out and want to help somebody else is when there's been a natural disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And then outpouring of people who want to help. And don't get me wrong, I'm not downplaying that, because that's important and it's a great thing. But again, it shouldn't take 200 tornadoes to rip through Tuscaloosa, Alabama, in order to get people to come together.
Exactly.
It should take the levees breaking in New Orleans to get people to come together. And it shouldn't take Rodney King getting the hell beat out of him to get people up and wanting to do something to change things. We should see that every day. And we should want to do that every day.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And, you know, it kind of bothers me, too, sometimes that our country is so willing to go and help all the other countries. And, you know, and it's great that they want to go and help, you know, the Haiti disaster and different places. But we have disasters like that in our own communities. We have homeless people sleeping on the streets, people that are living in tents, people that don't have food and water. And we're not doing anything to help our own people.
And that's a fact, you know, but when they focus you on Japan or Haiti or any other country that has a natural disaster, what they're doing is saying, in essence, is look how bad they have it, and you don't have it that bad. And people get caught up in that. Yeah, you do have it that bad. You know what?
We do.
I used to drive around with my camera in the car, and one of the pictures that I took, and I'll never forget it, and I wish I still had it, but I was so proud of this picture because it showed the hypocrisy. I was in downtown Los Angeles, and the first interstate building, the tallest building down there, 72 stories, right? It was early, and there was a homeless man sleeping in a doorway on a cardboard box, and I got my camera out and I snapped a picture, and I thought to myself, wow, this man doesn't have nothing but this cardboard box, and yet the people who work in this building handle billions of dollars on a daily basis, and they will come in to work this morning and either step over him like he's not there or have him removed like he doesn't even count.
Right. That's sad.
That was so sad, you know, but that's the mentality. We got everybody chasing the almighty dollar, and it doesn't matter, because at the end of the day, it's you within your four-cornered room, which is your mind, and you got to deal with that. And eventually, you got to deal with God.
Amen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I just want to insinuate, too, is that, you know, I'm so glad and I'm proud of guys like you and me and other cats that do come home out the joint and come from the street life, and we set out to make a difference out here in these streets, you know, because kids is not going to listen to someone, not even their own parents, who's not lived that life, you know. And we as OGs, as they call us, we have to set that example for a lot of these young kids, you know, to understand that at the end of the day, there's no successful drug dealer. There's no successful thug. You know, there's no successful gangster, because they got a place for all of us, and that's the graveyard or the shoe. You feel me? So there's no misunderstanding on who control the game, because don't none of us hold no key to no penitentiary across America that we go in and out like it's our house, you know?
Right.
So we got to understand that the government hold the key to every prison outside America, inside America, you know? And we
Go ahead, my brother. Let me point this out, you know. Going back to talking to the youngsters and how can we get them to see the light or to take that step, you know? I asked a bunch of youngsters one day, how would they feel about being a slave? And, you know, the mentality of the day, oh, man, I wouldn't be no slave, you know, because I'm not moving, I'm not doing nothing, right? And then I tell them, well, actually, let me hit you with this, right? The 13th Amendment of the States Constitution states that slavery nor involuntary servitude shall exist within the boundaries of the United States or any territory subject to jurisdictions unless one has been duly convicted of a crime. Slavery was never abolished. They just changed it a little bit.
Yeah.
So after 1865, instead of the plantation, we moved to the concentration camps.
Amen, brother. And they don't understand that, man. They don't understand that the penitentiary game is no game where people used to say, well, you know, we get three meals and we go to the gym and work out and we kick it with our homies on the yard. Oh, no. You got now that in the state of Ohio, you know, that they pay now to keep their TVs on. You feel me? They pay the state every month now. You feel me? Out their little state money. So it's getting to the point where they do not give a damn about you. You know, you're going to pay your way through, and they're going to make sure they find out a way to keep your ass enslaved, and you're going to be paying.
Right. Well, see, here's the thing about that, right? The prison industry in this country, and I'm not even going to say this country. I'm going to start with just the state of California. It's a billion-dollar industry. It's a billion-dollar industry. You know, I was incarcerated when the emphasis changed from the little rehabilitation that it was to straight security. And you have all these corporations who are operating within the prison system, right? I mean, why would I pay you, as American Airlines, why would I pay you $16 an hour to be a flight reservationist when I could step inside the prison and pay them $8 an hour, minimum wage, or $18, whatever it is in California, and then, of course, the state is going to pay half of that because now they're going to charge you for being a citizen.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like you said, they pay them to keep their televisions on. You know, you remember a few years back when they got on Nike and Michael Jordan for the shoes being made in Thailand, and they paying these people $1 a day, and the shoes are being sold over here for $150.
Right.
Yeah, that was a big thing, and Mike said he didn't know nothing about that, and they changed that up a little bit when all that came out. But it's just so much how they try to slick their own people, and I just want to iterate this, you know, while we're on that subject. Everybody always be talking about, you know, we the greatest country in America and all of that, you know. If we such the greatest country in America, why is the greatest country in America owing China so many billions of dollars? If you the greatest country, that means you owe no man. You owe no woman, you know? And how done sold America's out? You done sold America all the way out. And American people ain't even truly recognizing when they say America owe China all this kind of money. This country been selling people out. You feel me? Everybody can have a good time except the people who's been born, raised, and built this country. You know, we still catch the flack, but other people can come from other countries and they got to pay income tax for 7 years and all of that. You know, so there, to me, there's no great country as far as I'm concerned.
And that's true, because you know what? You're only as great as your citizens. And overwhelmingly, particularly in this country, overwhelmingly the gap between the middle, I'm not even going to say there's really a such thing as a middle class. You know, you got these politicians who promote, well, middle class, and we got to get a tax break for the middle class. The middle class really doesn't exist. There's rich and there's poor.
Right.
You have people right now who will wake up tomorrow morning and make a conscious decision on whether or not to put gas in their car or food on their table.
Right.
And allegedly, in the richest country in the world, which, of course, we know that that's a lie because, again, China owns the debt. You just said.
Right.
So if China owns our debt, then we can't be the richest country in the world.
Thank you.
Because they bought the debt. That we
right.
Can't get. Right. But, I mean, you know, it's important to note, too, right, a lot of brothers who come out of the prison system, right, they think that they can't vote because they've been convicted of a crime. And that's not true. You cannot vote if you are currently incarcerated or if you are currently on parole or probation under a felony. But notice they do keep us under the paperwork. But my point being is, once you clear all that, once you are no longer on parole, you can vote.
Right, and they got the game twisted because they make cats think that you can't vote, you can't do this, you can't do that. But
that you can vote for.
Right.
Come on, man.
And I want to just thank God for my boy, you know, Orville coming home, and he already got a job. He's been home 11 days. He's already working. And this cat's been out here and ain't been to penitentiary talking about they can't get no job. How do a man come out of the joint after 18 years and he automatically go get him a gig, you know? So for all you guys and women out here that's claiming ain't no jobs and you can't get no job, you need to start looking at a little bit closer to the game, because a man just come home after 18 years and got him a job. So that should tell you something.
Right. Been out 11 days.
Yep.
Yeah. And of course, you know, we can't downplay the fact that the employment situation in America right now is at an all-time low, particularly in terms of us, you know, because when we was working for free, there was work all day, every day.
It wasn't you couldn't even put in enough hours.
but,
they put some hours on top of them hours. Oh, you want some more hours? Man, we got you. Come on down here.
From sun up to sun down, you understand me?
But at the end of the week, you looking for that check, and he was like, hey, you know, this is all volunteer, B.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Yeah, and you know, and my man raised the clock now because he's like, shit, I've been working all week to get mine, you know what I mean? So, you know, America got the game twisted, man, and it takes guys like you, me, and Orville and other cats that we know to put it out there, man, because, you know, you have to educate people about what's real out here, and what's real is that America is not the greatest and richest country. To me, as that's my own perspective, to me, America is always in everybody else's damn business, you know?
Right.
And killing everybody for their own gang and taking over everybody's country for their own gang and shipping all that heroin and dope over here from Afghanistan and all of that. And you know they got the big drug deal with China, so you know they you know, everybody eating but us.
Right.
Now, I did want to point out the employment situation in California. It's particularly bad right now, and it's getting worse. Now, you know, we already have to contend with the white folks to get hired on a lot of jobs, right?
Amen.
And we already know how they feel about us or how the situation is going to go. Now, I'm not saying all white folks are like that, but...
Right, I say the same thing, because all white folks ain't bad, you know?
But then, we got to deal with the Koreans, who will never hire us.
Right.
The Indians from India, who won't hire us.
Hey, little monster. Hey, let me say something to you. Let me say something before you finish, man. This go trip you out, man. You just spoke on Indians, right?
Yeah.
Me and my wife was riding down this one street down here in Arizona by our house here in Arizona, and she was pointing out, she said, yeah, you know, all that's over there, that's the Indians' land over there, you know? And we riding and riding and riding. I'm like, damn, you know, they got a lot of land, you know, you can't even see across that land, right? So I told the missus, I say, well, it, you know, not trying to be, you know, a difficult man at this moment, but why the brothers ain't got no land, you know what I mean, and no 40 acres in the mule, and these Indians got all this land down here in Arizona. I'm like, where the brothers land at, you know? So I think America got the game totally, totally distorted, man, because, you know, ain't no Indians built no White House, you know?
Right.
Ain't no Indians put one brick nowhere, you know? Okay, I understand that, you know, you was living on your TPs and all of that shit. I understand that. But the black people were slaves, man, in chains. You feel me? And built this shit piece by piece, brick by brick. And they ain't gave a black man or a black woman now acre, not one. And these Indians down through Arizona got 300-400 acres.
Right.
And more than that. I'm just going on the small road. You dig?
Right.
The state of Arizona got to go through them when they want to put something on their land.
On their land, yeah.
They have to make a deal.
Because that land is,
you ain't heard the killing this part, monster.
Okay.
They got their own casinos down here, homeboy, and banks.
No. It's the same in California, right? The reservations are considered as a sovereign nation.
Right.
So, of course, you know, that's their land. Now, what they're doing with the casinos, I mean, they're making money. And if it's bringing that particular tribe up, then so be it. I'm not mad at them about it. I know
can't be mad.
I know in California, you know, the tribe, the less money you get. But the smaller the tribe who has a casino, you know, I know some members of tribes, and they can leave anything from $15,000 to $20,000.
Right. From the casino. So that's what I'm trying to say. Where did all this break down at, where the black man or the black woman didn't get their due? But the Indian got his due. I mean, I'm still trying to figure this one out, brother. You know?
Well, see. You know what they're doing with us is they saying your land is in the shoe or the cemetery.
Hey, hey, little monster man, don't make me laugh at you up on here tonight, man.
That's not even right.
That's the though. You know?
But for sure, they do.
They gonna get a brother man two things. They gonna get him the graveyard land, or you gonna go on here in this penitentiary and you gonna sleep on this this brick bed. So we ain't gonna give you no land, and we definitely ain't gonna give you no 40 acres and a mule. So we got you hooked up every time you do wrong. We got you straightened out right away. We put you in the system. But we gonna get these Indians. We gonna get them a lot of land. And we're going to get them their casinos, and we're going to get them very comfortable. But the black man, he's going to still be what we want him to be, and that's a nigga.
Right. That's it.
Bottom line.
Well, on that note, the black people need to quit calling black people nigger because you're putting each other down.
But hey, like I try to tell my wife, Martha, that's what we are to them, you know?
Right,
and we're going to always be that to them, you know?
You know, I don't even believe that because I've never thought that. And I would never call a black person that. But you guys do it every other sentence. So you're putting each other down instead of building each other up.
That's an excellent point.
That's what I feel because I would never, ever, ever call somebody that. I don't even like to say it in front of my husband. You know, and that's how I feel about it. I think it's a derogatory remark. And if, you know, you guys want to start respecting each other, call each other something else. Because that's, I think, a very derogatory term to call each other.
Yeah, and I try to tell her that's true, monster. But at the same time, you know, I let her know that the quote-unquote, the powers that be, that's what we are still in their eyesight.
Right.
Well, see, I try to get her to understand that. With the power that be in America, you know, all white people ain't bad. Because I got some very, very close friends that's white, that's been my friends for many years, you know?
Yeah,
But the quote-unquote white people that don't care about blacks at all, we going to always be a nigga in their eyesight.
Well, see, first of all, you know, it is a very derogatory term. We know where it originated from, and it's a dehumanizing term. It's the same thing that gang members do. You know, they call Crips Crab or Blood Slob and these all these different names. It was no different than America being in Vietnam and calling them Charlie or some other derogatory So, it's a form of dehumanization, and it just makes that much easier to look at the next brother and pull the trigger on him.
Right.
Right.
Because you've already dehumanized him.
You already know it. So, on that note right there, we're going to ask Ms. Yolanda, does she got any more questions for Mr., you know, Kashawn?
Hello.
You still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Yeah, do you have any remarks on what we've been talking about?
Yeah, well, it was so funny when you were talking about Indians, Native Americans. You know, a lot of them have lands, but you know, a lot of them have a lot of problems that's pervasive and running rampant in the blacks and poor communities of the country. Is that a lot of they may have a lot of land, but you know, a lot of them still live in squalor, and the alcoholism. I used to get this newspaper, and it was talking about there was this one community this person wrote about, and that one time they had 80-95% alcoholism. And then all of a sudden it dropped off, and they're like, yeah, you know, it's a big change. Well, the guy wrote back and said the change was that the people that were stricken, the 95%, most of them, if not all of them, were dead, you know. And so that's, you know, nothing that, so, you know, putting up casinos and you know, because they treated, you know, even though, you know, Indians got a bad run. You know, my grandmother, I have on both sides of my family, come from Native American and black families, and you know, you didn't tell anybody that because you know, Indians were thought to be savages and this, that, and the other, so you didn't own that part of your heritage. That's why a lot of you know, black people don't have a sense of pride, because you know, I come from a lot of people. I have a great grandfather picture hanging on my wall of my great grandfather who was Dutch, and his father was a Caucasian man who apparently, you know, he just didn't leave his, I don't know if he was his worker or whatever, with a baby, he left her with land too. So, you know, and it comes down to is how you feel about yourself and the attitude you care about. You can't worry about what somebody thinks, because what they think deep inside is really how they feel about themselves. And people, you know, who are who have that kind of mentality, you know, there's nothing you can address, because there was, somebody had put on Facebook, that was, like, I'm kind of get off the subject a minute, was putting up a survey saying that this survey, it was a psychological study that just showed that black women are the least desirable of all races, that he quoted some study, and then he put it on the blog, and then he started spreading it around. And mm-hmm. I said, you know what that's all about. That's about attack. You're trying to break someone's spirit. See, the Native American spirit was broken. You know, they tried to break and the spirit of black people and people of color or whoever it is. You know, it's not even, you know, you can't even say it's white people, because, you know, it was white people that made the way for Harriet Tubman to get where she was going. You know, there were white people that put signs in their window who stood up to their own folk and got killed. I mean, was it John Brown who was hung for standing with Harriet? Yeah, so, you know, you have to have a good attitude about yourself. You have to know the source of you is way bigger than people with attitudes, money, worlds, or politics. And that's where I do my best to live from. I know who speaks to me in the morning. I know who wakes me up. And God is a universal God, not a man in a box. It's like, okay, you do that, I'm going to get you, and then I'm going to pay you back. You know, that's what he's trying to awaken in us, and I think that's what's awakening in a lot of people, that awaken in you, Cody, all these to change, to have a consciousness shift, because this world is changing. You know, we're not, you know, races and all this kind of stuff, you know, that's just another, for me, a lot of people, I mean, for identifying people, yeah, well, the lady with the blonde hair or whatever, yeah, she's a black lady, you know, but not to separate. So many people want to be separate, or they feel separated when we're not, you know, we're not, we have the same DNA strand, the same grid, everybody has that. That when they found Lucy, in Africa, there's a distinct strand to the female genetic code, And every woman in this world has that. And that came from Lucy. That they extrapolated from Lucy. So, you know, that kind of stuff can keep you down if you focus on it and you know, and you're right that this country didn't do right by their promises, but people who live right will see the benefits. You know, God is way bigger than all that.
Amen.
You know?
Amen. You know, I want to touch on something that you said, Yolanda. Consciousness, either through Christ or through a conscious in a national sense, right, goes a long way. I stopped using the nigger word when I became conscious, and I looked back and I read the history of my people and the struggles that they went through in this country, and they didn't do all of that. So I can stand on the street and call the next brother a nigger.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, so consciousness, either through Christ or through a political aspect of it, will goes a long way. But you're right. We can't get caught up. See, we can't get caught up in the these people holding us back. Because you know what? Check this out. And me and my sister were talking about this today, right? You talk to young people, and you can point out to them how, you know what, it's real easy for you to go to college. Fill these papers out. Get from up under the dependency of your parents, and you can get this financial aid. And these young people tell you, oh, I don't want to go in debt like that. But then they'll turn right around and go in debt behind a vehicle.
Right.
Yep.
That don't make sense. Now, won't go in debt to do something that's going to help you get further in life, but you're getting to get something that'll get you around a corner.
Right. And it depreciates the minute you drive it off the lot.
Right, right. The moment you drive it off the lot, you know, it didn't lost $10,000.
You're upside down already.
I mean, so yeah. I mean, and these are things that I talk to young people about. You know, what should be part of the state control curriculum throughout high schools and middle schools is the importance of credit and how to use it. You know, that should be part of the curriculum. Because, again, if you don't have credit nowadays, you're not getting that to begin with.
Right.
Right.
You know, so, you know, we start with all. And you know what? What I taught my children, I have six children, and what I taught my children is this, right? Be the best possible person that you can be. Now, out of my six kids, I got four boys and two girls, just like my mother had. I've lost my oldest. I'm not going to say I've lost him, but he's in prison. I couldn't reach him. But now I have one who is in the military, and he's doing excellent. I have another who was ready to go to the military. Now, and again, I was against that. But then I looked at the employment situation and my sons reaching their potential. And if this can help you reach your potential, as opposed to you graduating from high school and maybe not wanting to take that loan out, because I can't send you to college, dude. I don't have that money. So you need to take that loan out. And again, you don't want to go in debt? Okay. But my one son who is in the military, it has helped him out tremendously because it has taught him discipline. More important than anything else, it has taught him discipline. And that right there will carry him through life.
Right, and it'll also help him get his education if that's what he chooses.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly. So, yeah. So I mean, there are avenues that our children can take. And again, I'm not saying that the military is the way to go. I mean, but neither is drug sales.
Right.
And everybody's not going to the NBA and to the NFL.
Right. Right.
So,
no, I think that
the
biggest thing that go ahead, Krishan, finish your sentence.
No, I was done.
I was just saying, I was just thinking that the biggest thing that we need to all come together and teach the youth is, you know, not to look down on anybody else, because, you know, we're all human beings and we all have more in common than we do differences, really. And, you know, I was, I guess, raised not to be, you know, racist or prejudiced or anything. And I grew up in Southern Arizona, you know, near the border. We had immigrants that used to come over and work for my dad, and, you know, they'd get hauled back to Mexico and they'd be back 2 days later. You know, my dad had a room for them to stay in with a bathroom, and he, you know, we fed them, and, you know, and through the years, there's been several people like that, that came and stayed with us. And, you know, we brought in Native American students from the reservation. That was through our church, but every school year my parents, I think as far back as I can remember, had one or two Native American foster students through the school year. They'd go home in the summer. They'd come back next year, you know, and they were part of our family for years. They still are. They still communicate with us. You know, I've never really, we didn't have a lot of Black people in our community when I was growing up, but I was never against or racist towards anybody. You know, I had a lot of good friends as I got out of school and moved to Phoenix. You know, I met some, you know, I had a lot of Black friends. So it's just that I've never been taught to be, you know, racist or prejudiced. And, you know, it just kind of breaks my heart to, as a white person even, to feel that, you know, that Blacks still don't like whites, or whites still don't like Blacks. Or, I mean, there's so many different races nowadays, you know, in America. We used to be known as the melting pot, and we were proud of that. And now, you know, I'm working on a book about gangs and drugs and corruption in the United States, and my subtitle is The Melting Pot of Corruption, because that's what it is. And, I mean, and it is. And, you know, the Irish came and they had their gangs. The Italians came, they had their gangs. The Germans came. I mean, everybody's got their gang, their mafia, their, you know, their crew, their, you know, their set, whatever, you know. You know, and then, you know, you got the Black on Black crime, and, you know, why are Bloods against Crips? And you're all, you know, originally were Black people from the hood in, you know, Los Angeles or whatever. But, you know, I was just thinking, and today when we were talking about the reservation and stuff out here, I was telling Rob, because we are in an area here where there are a lot of, you know, I'm in Arizona still, there's the immigration law right now going on, you know, there's a lot of fields out here where we live, and there's a lot of immigrants that have come for many, many years working in these fields. And I was telling Rob, you know, why don't they allow these people that have been here already for hundreds of years to remain here, make them citizens, and let them pay taxes just like we do? They are the ones, actually, you know, these guys that work out here 12 hours every day in the hot sun of Arizona in the fields picking fruit and vegetables are doing that because, you know, quote, what, you know, unquote, the white people won't do those kind of jobs. They think they're too good.
Right.
And then I told Robin, I don't think the Black people would do it anyways. He's like, wait a minute, we picked cotton.
For free at that.
They're not down here doing it because there weren't a lot of Black people in Arizona. It was Hispanic. You know, he's like, you know, up in Indiana or Detroit or somewhere else, you would see that, Mississippi, Tennessee, wherever, you would have seen the Black people out in the field, because that was the job. You know, it depends on where you're at, I guess. But to me, you know, it just bothers me that so many people, you know, can't get along, because we do. We are such a diverse country as far
as... And, you know what, let me say this. It comes down to the politicians, right? You spoke on corruption, right? And that's what a corruption is, all right? You know, these politicians will campaign and beg for your vote, but when they win, well, now you're no longer concerned, because now it's all about lining their pockets and what they can do for their circle. And that's what it's all about. Look, these politicians get in office, and they're not working for you, vote them out. And it doesn't matter if they're Black, white, brown, green, yellow, it doesn't matter, right? you know, California went from the world's seventh largest economy to bankruptcy. How does that happen? It's the politicians.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, if from the White House on down, it doesn't matter. If they're not working for you, if they're not doing the job that you need them to do, then get them out. You know, every year in California, the legislators pretty much shut down the government because they can't agree on a budget. This is ridiculous. Get them all out. Replace them all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when unemployment is at 9%, 10%, get them all out because none of them are doing the job.
Right.
You know, that's how important voting is. It really is important. People need to know that they have that right, whether they've been convicted of a crime. You have that right to vote once you get from up under that paperwork. Exercise that right.
That's an important thing to start educating people about, because I wasn't even aware of that.
Mm-hmm. You know, the only thing that permanently takes your right to vote is treason. And, of course, if you get convicted of treason, your chances of ever getting to a voting booth again are slim and none.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, again, people need to exercise their right. A lot of young people came out and they voted during the presidential election of 2008, and it propelled Obama to the White House.
Right.
But we need to get involved in these midterm elections. People need to get involved in these local elections, because some of these politicians are just straight up scary.
It's like
they came out of Nazi Germany in the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So
yeah, we need some young, fresh people in there that can make things happen and do the right thing.
Right. You know, the government is supposed to be for the people, by the people. It's not supposed to be for one person. You know, during the government election last year in California, you know, the lady who created eBay, started eBay, I forgot what her name was, but, you know, how do you spend $100 million of your own money for a job that's going to pay you what, $200,000, $300,000 a year?
Hmm.
That doesn't add up. But see, in the end, after she gets to office and makes all her backroom deals, she's going to get that money back tenfold. And that's how they don't know how to spend it like that. You know what I mean?
Right.
You know, and of course, you've got to have that type of money to run for office nowadays anyway. You know,
right.
If I wanted to run for office, I don't even have enough money to fill out the paperwork.
Right. Unfortunately, money talks.
Yeah. But, you know, again, the winds of change are blowing, and they're blowing hard. Like Yolanda said, there's a wave of consciousness, and it's coming. It's enveloping the people, the young people. We're in an information age where information is right at your fingertips, you know. And, yeah, it's censored and it's slammed, but you got to be able to decipher what's real and what isn't. And,
right.
You know, keep moving forward. Keep striving forward. Keep striving to be the best possible person that you can be. And, you know, I used to say, you can't change a person. You really can't, right? If you don't like me for something that I've done, right, I can't change that, right, or something that I do or the way that I act. I can't change that because I'm not going to change because you don't like me, right? But now, if I do change my behavior, not necessarily for you, but just to say, because you know what, damn, I don't want to be an asshole anymore, right? And I do change that behavior, then you will look at me and say, damn, well, you know what? Kirk Shaw changed, so now I'm going to change my attitude towards him.
Mm-hmm.
You feel me?
I mean,
that's change. That's change. And, again, it starts with yourself. It starts with each of us as individuals. And just understanding what is it that we want out of life. What is it that we want? If we want to live in fear, if we want to live looking over our shoulders and wondering when that bullet with my name on it is going to come get me, then continue on the path. Because gang banging, like I said, it's not a lifestyle. It's a death style.
Wow. Yeah. That's so true.
Yeah, so what we're gonna do right now, we're gonna go to a couple commercials, and we're gonna be right back with our man Kashawn in a few minutes.
Money, power, respect, trash, prison, death. A new book, The Streets Don't Love You Back, by Robert Boyd. To educate the youth, order the book right now online at thestreetsdontloveyouback.ning.com, a place where positive things happen. The new social networking site developed by Robert Boyd and Lucinda to educate the youth. Come join the movement. You can make a difference.
Stay tuned every Wednesday at 11:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time with your hosts, Boyd and Lucinda, for the hottest talk show in existence. The Streets Don't Love You Back.
Everybody's out here talking about all that thug life, Flair. Talking about that drug dealing thing. Tell you, baby, it's about getting your life together, getting your head on tight, doing something with your life and stop destroying your community. Stop destroying yourself, baby. But when the people come at you, they come for real, Flair. Homeboys on my
streets don't love you back. Come join the movement at thestreetsdontloveyouback.ning.com.
I sat in an empty apartment. I found a 9mm under the kitchen sink, and I stuck it up to my head, and I was ready to pull the trigger and ready to die. You know, I knew what I made of my life was a living hell. My name is Joe, and I'm 20 years old. I'm from Apache Junction, Arizona, and I started using meth when I was 16. I was doing about 8-ball a day, and it was terrible. It was lonely, you know, being out using it was lonely because all the friends that you had before, they want nothing to do with you. And I pulled my oldest brother into it, got him wrapped up and involved in it, and, you know, the first time he tried it, he was hooked. You don't realize that it's not only hurting yourself, but it's hurting everybody around you. I look back now, I mean, everything I said that I didn't want to be is what I turned out to be, because I know how bad I was, and I know how many people I've hurt around me. I know that that's not something that I'm wanting to do again.
Brought to you by the Arizona Meth Project.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're right back with our man, Kashawn, a.k.a. Lil Monster. We're going to give you your closing shout-outs to anyone you would like to give a shout-out to. And we also would like for you to give your contact information out to your organization for people who would like to reach you. And if you have a website, you can get that out as well.
Okay. My closing thoughts, statement is this, right? When you get involved with gangbanging, get involved with the gang, it's not just you. You are involving your entire family. And as I came up, I didn't realize that then. I didn't even think about it. I didn't think about that I was putting my mother in danger. I was putting my sisters in danger, my two older brothers who had nothing to do with it. So when you do that, again, you're putting your entire family in danger because bullets don't have names on them. And as we know, they hit anybody. So think about that. Understand that the end result is the penitentiary or the cemetery. And so for those who have been listening, who are in the struggle for freedom, for life, I say keep moving. Keep it moving. Keep moving forward with it. For those who would like to reach me, you can reach me. My name is Kershawn Scott, and you can just look me up on Facebook, and I'm there, just like that, Kershawn Scott.
And Kershawn, you said are you in Maryland now?
Yes, I am in Maryland.
Okay. Did you move up there?
Kind of, sort of, no. I came on a visit. I came on a visit to visit my sister, and she kind of asked me to house sit for her as she is working out of the country. So that's what I'm doing right now.
Temporary.
Yeah, I'm a Cali boy.
Right. That's what I thought.
And there's nothing like California.
Right.
My man. You know. All right, Miss Yolanda, you have anything to say?
You there, Yolanda?
Oh, sorry, I had to mute out for a second. I was on the computer doing something. But, yeah, I just appreciate you coming on and doing what you're doing and just know that I've said this before, that, you know, every pebble makes a ripple in the brook. You know, you can't control what politicians do or people's thoughts about other people, but if you're out there a powerful force to be reckoned with in the terms of being positive, and love is so much stronger than hate. You know,
right.
You can love all day, you know, and people will form and you'll attract people to you, the right people to you. You know, mm-hmm. I don't discount any friendship or any opportunity because it could be that one person that may seem small, not big or whatever, that can flip a switch on thousands. And you just have to keep doing it. And I hope the youth can hear that, you know, and not buy into what other people have done and how people have misused other people. You know, there are checks and balances in this universe. We live in the reciprocal universe, and people that have done wrong, see, that all that has already come undone. They've been found out. Everybody's, you know, the carpet has started coming off, even, you know, with Enron. And people's wrongdoing has been brought to the light, you know, Madoff and people like him, you know, he didn't rip off any black people that I knew. He ripped off a lot of rich Caucasian people, his friends, his family. You know, for nothing. You know, made paper money, you know, lying and doing whatever. You know, but, you know, you see how that it came to him, and his son ended up committing suicide because they were investigating him. You know, you see how the universe brings balance. I mean, we reciprocate. What we throw out there, it finds us. You know, if we don't change, it will find us. So those people that are misusing things, you know, I don't even worry about that. I'm getting to try to experience my God every day in every way, and the more I do it, the more I know that God is way bigger than all that and way better.
Yep.
And you can have the life you want to have. Rob, you doing it? You came out of prison. You seen your friend? Oh, here he is. A week later, what did he say? Oh, the statue.
11 days.
And mm-hmm. Yeah, 11 days.
He
had all stacks against him. What's the stats on a black man coming out of prison getting a job? And if he's focused on the stats, he probably would still be unemployed. But he focused on his skills and kept his eyes ahead, and there he is working, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have to think positive in order to get positive.
Right. The universe just bounces it back to you. Whatever you keep saying, I'm a loser, they hate me, well, that's what you get. You know, I've ran into it. I live in Texas, and I've ran into it. I can go, there's not too many places. And, you know, right down the street in Pasadena, the Klan was living there, had a headquarters there. But, you know, what's so neat, why I love, you know, and not that I, you know, particularly, I thought it was so funny. I said, that's what I love about Mexicans. When they move in droves.
Right.
You got down there, Pasadena is Mexico now. Pasadena is Mexico now.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I said, you just never know. I said, but, you know, I never ran into anybody, even if they had, you know, you met people. I worked at a bank who have attitudes about, you know, certain people or certain groups or certain individuals, but you have to let them be with that attitude. That attitude is affecting them. It's changing the cell in their body. If they're hating, they're creating colon, colon cancer. Because when you hold on, however harsh feelings against others, that's why so many people are manifesting cancer. And it's like, oh, it's the environment. No, it's your thoughts. It's the attitude you held on to. It's your refusal to change, your refusal to forgive. You know,
mm-hmm.
forgive people. You know, there are a lot of people that are, you know, doing wrong, but it's a whole lot of people doing right.
Amen.
I mean, a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
So we just have to just make sure whatever we're throwing in the brook, that's what we want to see come back to us. And, you know, and to give, I mean, and give generously, you know, and you watch how the universe turns it back to you.
Right.
Amen.
No, I think I said this once before. You know, if something bad happens at your job or somewhere, you know, people are going to just go out and tell the next person what happened right away.
Uh-huh.
You know, because they're so anxious to say how somebody else screwed up or something, you know. But if something
uh-huh.
good happens, they don't go run out and tell everybody right away.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Just behaviors.
Right.
Behaviors.
It is. And, yeah, so, you know, we need to change, I guess, the way that the youth are thinking and
uh-huh.
you know, teach them how to get along with others and that, you know, that everybody, you know, really are not that different.
Right. That's a fact.
Everybody is not bad, and it's a lot of people who don't want to help. If a person don't know you have a problem, then they don't know you need help.
Uh-huh.
So we have to speak out.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yes, indeed. So with that being said, we just want to say that we done had a great, great show tonight. And, we just want people to take heed to the message that was told here tonight. And you have all the information if you would like to get in contact. And don't forget to join the movement at the streetsdontloveyouback.ning.com, and also order the new book, The Streets Don't Love You Back and Never Hit a Woman. And we just ask you to just get involved with a lot of community people that's doing the right thing out here to uplift not only our community, but uplift people as well.
Uh-huh.
Definitely. And Krishan, keep in touch with us. Let us know when you're back in Cali. You know, we're working with a few people out there as well, you know, Freeway, Skip Townsend, Ken Smith, you know, we just last week talked with Reginald. And so, you know, we're hooking up with people from the East Coast to the West Coast and, you know, we're asking everybody to be a part of the Streets Don't Love You Back movement so that we can, you know, get together, you know, and get all of, you know, the OGs and people that have survived the,
mm-hmm.
you know, the battle. And, you know, we're trying to put together some things to be able to bring out to the different cities in the United States and you know, have youth rallies and talk to the youth and you know, hopefully make a difference.
Uh-huh.
Well, thank you guys for having me on. And, again, I appreciate the outlet. And I love the name Streets Don't Love You Back because the streets don't change. It's just
appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, only thing changed is the players in the game, but the game remained the same. They ain't finna they definitely ain't finna come in and change how you cut dope. You know what I mean? They definitely ain't finna come in and change how you smuggle it, because they know how you get it here from the tires to the doors to up in the air. You know, so you ain't finna come in and bring no new technology unless you finna be a Bill Gates. And send a technology where it can go through a computer, and I doubt that.
And the streets are made of concrete, and concrete is unforgiving.
That's right.
So, yeah, these young cats, man, they be thinking they the first one picked up a pack of dope and a pistol, man. I'd be laughing at some of these young cats, man, because I'd be like, is you serious? You think you invented that, man?
Right. Well, let me say this, and I know we're out of time, but this is important, right? Because there's so many cats out there who are still pushing dope, and they say, well, this is all I know how to do. No, think about this, right? Because if you're out there pushing dope, then you are a salesman. Change your product. It's the same thing. Change your product.
That's what Rob was saying the other day. It's nothing but a marketing scheme, you know.
Yes.
You've got a bunch of people under you and a bunch of people under them, and you're, you know, telling them how to do it, where to go, what to do, when to pick it up, when, you know, and it's nothing. I mean, that's a business. Just change your product. You're right. Definitely.
Well, good night, and again, thanks for having me, and everybody, keep it moving.
Oh, thank you, man, and have a great
time.
Thank you for being a guest on our show.
We really appreciate it. Thank you, Yolanda. And we just want everyone to join us next Wednesday night. We have a lady named LaDonna Smith who survived a domestic violent relationship and then wrote a book about it. So she's going to be on to share her story with us next week. So once again, thank you, Krishan, and good luck with all your endeavors. And we wish you the best.
All right. Thank you.
All right, good brother. Have a good one now.
Thank you.
Right,
we're going to go out with a song here. Let me see. We're going to go out with a song, In Need of a Change, by LD out of Cincinnati, Ohio. Have a great week. Remember, the streets don't love you back. And join us next Wednesday night.
Yeah. LD. You know, far too often, we look back in hindsight and wish, say, I wish I just had one more chance. This is it. This is it. That second chance. Feeling like a mystery once I realize that I'm still here. And sometimes these regrets won't let me forget that I done let down the best of my years. But you can see the drive in my eyes and the hidden surprise, because I haven't searched up to see. And with my tears in the sky high, soak the sunshine, life is on the line with no place to see. As I'm in need of a change, maybe from the inside out. Let these superficial strangers try to shut my mouth. I done seen a lot of things that I never talked about. If I could do it all again, I'd never let them in my house. I done made some mistakes, apologize and reconcile. I done changed all my ways from what I was as a child. Stood on my mama's grave, rain poured down from the clouds. Dropped to my knees and prayed I'd have a reason to smile. Was a young kid looking hard, running around any street, chasing girls, thought I learned all the world had to teach. But one day I lied awake, realized I didn't know it, and it hit me like a brick. Wish I could do it all again, but I can't, and I ain't. Anyway, I read and brave, write my future like a book. As I turn another page, as the lights go down, I walk across the stage, rub the law full up, but more importantly, I pray that everything will be okay. And somehow I know it is. All I gotta do right now is get through this bullshit. Keep my chin to the sky, put my back against the wall. Fuck out, I will fight, scratch and claw, and still stand tall in the belly of the beast. Be afraid of nothing in this world, it's got to be. Sometimes I feel slip if I forget my sleep, but that's why I hit my knees soon as I lose the sheet. No more waiting. Life is not a game. Sometimes you might not get a second chance. Life. What you got. Don't be jealous of others. Do for your damn self.